of the program. So after we talk to Mary, we've got an action-packed day full of artists in the exhibition. We will first talk to the artist Dred Scott, who is in the exhibition, and we will, he has a long history of political art making and activism, so it should be exciting to talk to him. He's a great speaker also. He's come a few times to different classes that I've taught, and he's a very engaging speaker. After Dred, we'll talk to the artist Ricardo Dominguez, who is working with the electronic Carla, would you hand me the checklist? Thanks. Who's doing electronic arts disturbance, and I'm doing a bad job of electronic disturbance theater. See, I knew theater was in there, I just wasn't sure where. We will talk to him at 2 p.m., and I believe we'll be talking to him from a sit-in today, so that should be exciting. We'll be talking about his piece that's on the internet that you can access from if you go to radiofreeerica.net and click on the Watch What We Say exhibition banner. That'll take you to the Watch What We Say website. On that website, each artist has a link through the gallery to their own sites and projects, and he's got a project up right now that is with the help of people uploading the site. It is going to jam the Republican National Convention's homepage. So we'll be talking to him about his projects at 2 p.m. and then after, Ricardo will talk with the artist Jenny Polak about her images in the exhibition and the web component as well. She's done some interesting work in relation to prisons in the United States, and her most recent projects have to do with the idea of hiding away or being a displaced person or a person that needs to hide from some sort of authority because of race or religion. So that's the program for today. We won't be talking to our man in the field, Wade Nasanovich, today because he is at his day job, which he is every day that we've been talking to him, but today he couldn't get away from the desk, so we'll be talking to him tomorrow about his commute today. He's right at FIT, which is sort of the heart near the Republican National Convention. So I have a number of things that I brought with the intention of reading today, but I never, because I was freaking out over over the technicalities of getting this to work today, I didn't get to actually choose which one I was going to read. So there's a few things. I'm talking to you from a dial-up modem today, which I've been warned, if somebody calls the gallery, can actually knock my link to the internet off. So if that happens, I'm going to have to redial up. If it happens multiple times when I'm talking to an artist, I can't promise that I'll continue to redial just because I think it's going to be impossible to hold any sort of conversation and continuously be uploading. So what I did want to read is an essay from Ricardo Levins Morales, which is from the book Reimagining America, The Arts of Social Change. It's edited by Mark O'Brien and Craig Little. And again, this is by Ricardo Levins Morales. I think I'm going to read for a little bit. Trying to decide if I want to pick a specific part out. And I think I will. I'll read the section, Art as the Dream Life of a People. And here it says, Ricardo Levins Morales is a Jewish Puerto Rican parent, artist, and organizer. He works for the Northland Poster Collective in Minneapolis. Is a distributor of Art of the Labor, Peace and Justice Movements, and is a coordinator of the Alliance for Cultural Democracy, a national network of cultural workers. Art as the Dream Life of a People. I learned the power of fantasy on the street. At age 11, I found myself uprooted from my Highland Puerto Rican barrio, wandering an alien maze of city streets. This new landscape was controlled by the Chicago police, armed and arrogant as an army of occupation, and by the competing remnants of the disintegrating street gang armies. All of these parties were intensely interested in young men of my age. I felt extremely vulnerable. The rules of survival itself seemed to be controlled by forces far beyond my own control. To survive on my own terms without being beaten up, ripped off, or recruited seemed too tall an order, for these were the only options offered. In my mind, I rehearsed 1,000 variations of confrontations in empty lots and dark alleys. Like most sensible young males, I avoided the brightly lit avenues where the police held sway. As I played out my daydreams and real-life encounters, I discovered an unexpected freedom. If I declared my own rules, sorry brother, I don't have much cash now and I need it all, they were often respected, even by those who should have been able to overrule me. I learned that my fantasies, a realm to which I retreated for comfort in the face of my fear, had provided me with real avenues for action. They had led me to discover that the supposed rules of the game are not the real rules. Once I ceased to consent to them, if, as the African revolutionary leader Amilcar Cabral described it, culture is the collective personality of a people, then the arts are its collective dream life. In the absence of coercive control, the arts, like dreams, are naturally drawn to the deepest hopes, fears, and truths that are suppressed in daily life. Whatever the stresses in your life you wish to avoid, you can count on encountering them in your dreams. One of my greatest inspirations has been the Latin American New Song movement, especially its Chilean pioneers. They transformed themselves from performers of and for the student left into the creators of an authentic voice for their people's aspirations, moving easily between songs of love and songs of land reform, between nonsense, verse, and traditional lament. They dissolved rather than accepting the barriers that divide politics from the rest of life. What these musicians accomplished was to master the dream language of their people as expressed in ancient and contemporary musical traditions. They then used it to voice the secret hopes and feelings that were not finding expression in the commercial culture monopoly, dominated by imported Western music. In a class society such as the United States, the so-called national art scene represents the rather confined dreams of a small segment of the population. It's considered a sacred duty for artists to remain isolated from any broad community that might influence their art. Artwork must remain personal in the narrowest sense, while fitting into the moment's specifications for saleable work. Alienation is one of the requirements. A friend told me of a Midwestern painter who finally got a favorable review of her show after having worked in New York for a couple of years. The critic was elated that, in contrast to her earlier optimistic paintings, her new work was starting to show the angst, depression, of a mature artist. The greatest form of pressure that cuts artists off from the living currents of their communities is the designation of some subject as quote-unquote political. As it applies to art, political is a clear no trespass sign forbidding access to whatever the ruling elite does not wish people to think about. It varies from country to country and over time. New York artist Lisa Blackshear's paintings of interracial couples would be politically explosive in South Africa, cause some discomfort in the U.S., and not raise an eyebrow in Brazil. In South Africa, the book Black Beauty was banned, for although it was a story of a horse, the linking of the two words in its title was seen as dangerously revolutionary by the censors. In General Pinochet's Chile, teaching evolution is seen as subversive because it describes a world in which change is constant and inevitable. It is therefore seen as challenging the rigid stability preached by the dictatorship. The political label and the funding, performance space, display, and publishing decisions that enforce it serves to prevent artists from fulfilling their function as conveyors and interpreters of their people's dreams. For the majority of the potentially artistic population, a form of dream suppression is practiced. Organic cultural expression is discouraged by the denial of resources, and the promotion of the arts is the province of a gifted few. In the crude tracking system of the schools and artists is whoever is left when the rest are bludgeoned into silence. Those who survive this assault on their creativity may pursue it through art schools, where they will be safely taught to respect the taboos. These systems of suppression and control are far from fully effective. At best, they work as damage control to limit the number of artists who survive and the imaginations of those who do. But still, artists who have been successful within the cultural industries, as well as those who develop outside of the educational system, are drawn by the gravitational pull upon the artist to explore every area of communal life. Too often, activist artists ourselves accept the no trespass signs of the elite, simply choosing to set up camp on the other side of them. Thus, we miss the subversive potential coming straight from the deepest springs of artistic inspiration. If we listen and convey the dreams of our people, we will ignore the signs and property lines. If we violate the warning signs, it will be while true to our mission as artists to grasp the full potential of cultural creation as an arena for social transformation. We must go beyond seeing ourselves as simply political artists, oppositional art, or even voices of dissent. That was by Ricardo Levins Morales from the book Reimagining America, The Arts of Social Change. So that was just a one part of his essay. I'm going to end there. I feel like it's nice to start each program with somebody else's words. And this program to me is really about other people's words more than about my own words. It's about collecting all of these amazing people that I find around me, and whether that means in geographical nearness or just emotional spiritual nearness. It's sort of gathering all of these people and giving a place to let them voice, and a place for me to learn. That's really. And the thing that's been so exciting in these last couple of days is that I truly feel like I've been learning great amounts from the people that have been on the air. And so I thank them, and I thank everyone who's been listening. So now we're going to call Mary Adams at her dress shop on the Lower East Side. We've been calling Mary pretty much every day to see how it's been going.
Mary Adams.
Hi, Mary. It's Erica.
Hi, Erica.
Hi, we're on the air.
I can't hear you very well.
You can't hear me very well? Can you hear me better now?
A little bit.
Okay, I have a
Maybe
new...
Maybe I'll turn off my air conditioner.
I've got a new headset because I'm calling from the gallery, so I have...
Oh.
And anyway, I've been having a lot of technical problems today, so... How are you?
Well, anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see, what do I have to say today?
Yeah, what happened on your walk? What have you heard on the radio?
Well, there wasn't much on my walk to work, because it's usually too early for everybody to be up protesting.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't anything at the Union Square yet, but last night when I was taking the bus home, there was a Palestinian group protesting the Palestinian situation, which is always good to see. And also, I was reminded that they're voting on the apartheid wall in the Senate this week or next week, and I'd like to urge people to call their senators.
Can you explain that a little bit, what that is?
The apartheid wall?
Yeah.
The wall that the... Israeli government is building to separate the Palestinians from the Israelis,
right.
But they're building it on Palestinian land and isolating people from their crops and their villages from other villages and basically creating a big mess and they're building it on Palestinian land, which is pretty much all their land anyway, but they're building it on Palestinian land, and they actually will have to literally let the Palestinians through with a lock and a key to, you know, field their crops in a lot of situations. But it's totally a bad situation for the Palestinians, and the U.S. Senate is voting to disregard the world, what's the group, the world court in Europe that just said that it was illegal to build the wall on the, they are voting to basically say that that's a, not a good decision, and that it's perfectly fine for the Israelis to build the wall. Right. So I'm urging people to call their senators and say that it's not a very good idea at all, and if they are going to build it, they can build it on their own property and leave the Palestinians alone, if that's possible. So, anyway, and then, so I went by the Palestinian thing, Union Square, and there was, I got down to 14th and 8th, which was surprising to me. They had a bunch of police there, and they were putting up a huge roadblock sign. And then I kind of forget it, that it's, they've got to like do stuff all over the city to stop, you know, to inspect people and keep people moving and organize and sort of interesting. And then of course there's helicopters flying over.
Right now?
No, in my area where I live, I live fairly close to this, the convention center, so there's going to be, you know, air activity and spotlights from the helicopters, and it's just like sort of a surreal scene, especially at night, to see the helicopters with these big spotlights, you know, shooting down on, it looked like they were spotlighting the Union Square area. But, so there's that. And I had a bride that I'm working with, a new bride, and she ends up that she's getting married right after the election. And she said her biggest worry about her wedding is if Bush wins, because her fiancé is going to be in a major depression.
Uh-huh.
All the people at her wedding will be really depressed.
Uh-huh. A lot of people will be.
Anyway. And what else?
So it is a fairly big police presence in your, like, walking or just around?
I was riding
square?
The bus.
Okay.
But I didn't see, when I walked to work today, there was no presence of anybody, protesters or police.
Uh-huh.
And, but it's too early for everybody. It's when I go home that it will all be...
Right.
The action will be more, because Union Square, there's always something at night.
Right.
So I guess that's a big place for... I mean, it's turned into a protest place. But isn't that why it's Union Square anyway? Isn't that where all the unions protested?
Oh, Mary, I don't know. People keep asking me all these questions, and I don't have... the right answer. But that sounds right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's
I think it has something to do with protesting and why it's called Union Square. But I guess I'll try to find out, and then I'll get back to you on that.
All right, do some research. Did you talk to your brother yesterday after you?
No.
No. I got a few nice emails from people saying how they enjoyed his segment.
Oh, good.
And I thought he was really interesting. And it emailed from people on the West Coast and stuff, too. It was nice.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I can hardly hear you, though.
You can. It's this new headpiece, and then also at the gallery, it's still industrial here, so there's... I'm competing.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like you're in a big old space.
Yeah, competing with trucks and heavy machinery.
What's that blinking thing?
Yeah, it's some sort of, there's a shipping company downstairs, and so they do unloading all day.
That's funny.
Yeah.
It sounds like a hospital thing, kind of.
Yeah.
I can't think of any other big political something or other that I have. I guess there's a lot of little protest groups going on that you probably saw in the paper, and somebody climbed the wall to the, I don't know if it was the plaza or someplace and dropped a huge flag or a huge protest sign, something
uh-huh.
about Stop Bush, and
some
activists took off all their clothes for AIDS and stood in front of the traffic.
Right. Yeah.
But, yeah, that's basically all I've heard so far.
How does it feel in the city? Does it still feel like summertime and sleepy, or does it feel like people are coming back?
No, it still feels very, you know, there's not very many people in town. It seems more and more deserted.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine what's going to happen on Sunday. You know, whether a lot of people will be coming into town or how they're even going to come into town.
Right.
And how many people are going to be there.
Yeah, I've been hearing that they're expecting between 250 and 500,000 people from out of town.
I can't really believe that's true.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
I was going to go out of town, and then I thought I have to stay.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to see what's going to happen.
It's momentous.
So... Yeah. Anyway, but I think I have to go because I have a whole pack of people in here all of a sudden.
Oh, okay. They all heard you on the radio and they came in.
What?
They all heard you on the radio and came in.
Oh. Maybe I should ask them who they're going to vote for.
Right. We're taking a poll. A radio poll.
I better
poll.
Not.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Mary.
Okay, and will I be talking to you tomorrow?
Yeah, are you going to be at the store tomorrow?
I'm not sure. I might be at home, but I will be going to Union Square in the morning, so maybe I'll have some news for you.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Do you know anything about the gathering? There's people gathering for Sunday at Union Square. Is it at 11 that the march is supposed to begin? Do you know any of the details?
I don't.
Okay.
I keep hearing different groups are marching, are going to be there, and I haven't
right.
heard.
Okay. All right, well, if I find out, which I'm going to try to, I'll let you know when I find out.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mary.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, that was Mary Adams from her dress shop on the Lower East Side. And Carla, would you plug that in for me, please? My cell phone is losing power. There's plugs over there. I don't know if it can fit into one of those. So I see that there's a message from Dredd on my telephone, and I'm wondering if he's wanting to talk on the telephone rather than come in person because he's not here. So let's check our messages.
Please enter your password. You have one new voice message. First voice message.
Hey, Erica, it's Dredd. I fucked up. I got on the wrong bus. And so I'm trying to make it to you by 1:30. I'm going to try and catch a car service, but I don't really know whether I can make it. I mean, if I can find the right bus or car service or something, I'll be there. But I might be a little bit late. So hope you can answer it. You can reach me by cell phone, 718-791-5401. Bye.
All right.
End of message. Message
if
erased.
For him.
End of music. Everybody.
Whoa. That made a crazy noise. Yeah. No. All right. Does it fit in now?
Now?
No.
No, I need to unplug something. Everyone's
okay. Maybe we can find someplace else. I mean, I'm not on total empty on the power, but I'm supposed to talk to Ricardo at 1. That's the actual box. Hey, in our studio, there's probably a extension cord. Yeah.
All right. So today the phone number to call in is not the 718 number that's on the website. It's my cellular phone, which is 917-414-0276. Feel free to call in and ask questions of like what's Union Square, or if you know what Union Square was named after. But if you have any questions, I can make up something to answer. And sometimes I actually do know the answer. And it'd be great to hear from you. So again, that number is 917-414-0276. Let's just talk about some of the other things that are coming up tomorrow. I'm going to be calling Esther Bar-Lev in Israel. She lives on a kibbutz in the Negev Desert in Israel, and I'm going to be talking to her about the weather there and what's growing on the kibbutz, and then also just what within that community people are saying about the upcoming U.S. elections, and you know what people are saying about what's going on in Israel as well. So that should be interesting. And tomorrow again, we'll be checking in with Wade about his commute in FIT. Tomorrow we'll also be talking to some people at the Abortion Rights March, a group of women that I've agreed to call in from our Dear Girlfriends art group. So it's an exciting day tomorrow as well. I'm in my head trying to figure out if I should give Dredd a call or if I should do some more reading. I think once we get the cell phone plugged in and onto an external power, then I'll feel more comfortable about calling. Tomorrow we will also be speaking with the artist Joy Garnett and Anne Messner, both in the Watch What We Say exhibition. We were lucky to have a small blurb in both Time Out and today's, thanks Carla, New York Times. I'm going to do this and hope that it doesn't. Okay, now we're on better power here. It's kind of amazing the difference it made. All right, so let's give Dredd a call on his cell phone. Hi, Dredd. It's Erica.
Hey.
Hi. Where are you?
I'm at Heavenhamer and South Fourth.
Okay, you're close.
Am I?
Havermere? I'm not sure exactly where Havermere is. South Fourth is not far, but I think.
I know. No, South Fourth is close, but I don't know where the hell Havermere is in relation to Bedford. But I'm not finding any car services or anything, so I'm walking. I know the direction.
Well, let's talk while you walk, or you can sit down. We're actually on the air now.
Okay, well, I will keep walking and hopefully come into the studio and we can do a changeover in a half second.
Okay, cool. I wish I could give you directions, and the internet connection is such crap here that I can't, I'm afraid to open up.
Oh, shit, and there finally was a cab that was empty, but it's gone.
I think you're close. Havermere is by the BQE, Carla's saying.
Yes.
You're far?
That I was aware of, but where is it in relation to Bedford?
Is it South 4th in Havermere? Do you know where it is in relation to Bedford Avenue? Okay, so, yeah, we think you need to walk towards the water if it
That I know that, but how far is it? Am I miles away or?
No, I don't think you're miles away. But
okay.
I'm notoriously wrong. So
okay.
at many things. So do you know which direction is the water from where you
are?
Yeah,
no, I can get there. I just don't know whether I'm 2 minutes away or 15 minutes away.
Right. Okay. So let's start with talking about the piece that's in the exhibition. Can you describe it for people who haven't had a chance to see the show or can't see the show because they're far away?
Well, I can try and do that. I mean, it's a screen print. It's got images of a person that's rowing a boat, and over that is images of presents and locks of hair and wedding rings, and I think that's about it. But there's also text, which is screen printed in basically a clear that you can barely read. I mean, from a distance, it just sort of looks like there's all this other stuff. And then when you get up close enough, you can see that there's text, and the text is actually a combination of two pieces of text, one from Toni Morrison's Beloved and the other from the Guardian newspaper. And the passage from Beloved is, it starts off, well, actually, if you can hold on for a second as I walk, I can go into my backpack and get out what the exact text was, because I thought it would be better to talk than what the exact text is. But let's see, can I do it? Yes, I found it. And now what it says is, 1874 and white folks are still on the loose. Whole towns wiped clean of Negroes. 87 lynchings in 1 year alone in Kentucky. 4 colored schools burned to the ground. Grown men whipped like children. Children whipped like adults. Women raped by the crew. And then it goes on to describe, and the wind is blowing, so I can't read it exactly, but it says that reaching for it, he thought it was a cardinal feather stuck to his boat. He tugged, and what came loose in his hand was a red ribbon knotted around the curl of wet woolly hair, still clinging to its bit of scalp. And it continues, bloody children's shoes, frayed school books, the scalp of a woman with braided gray hair, wedding decoration, makes clear that the women and children were killed by the U.S. bombing. The charred meat sticking to the rubble in black lumps could have been Osama bin Laden's henchmen, but survivors said it was the remains of farmers, their wives and children, and wedding guests. They said more than 100 civilians died at that village in eastern Afghanistan. And so the text actually just sort of seamlessly combines text from two different sources in two different periods, that I think reveals a lot about sort of what America is like here and sort of around the world.
Right. It's exactly pulling history. then is now, or now is then, still.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so it's a screen print, and you've got those two texts, and then can you talk about what's layered on top of that?
Well, I thought I did describe the text and the images, but perhaps I'm breaking up since sort of I'm on a cell phone and cell phone sucks. But it talked about it has these hello?
Yes.
It has these images of wedding presents and locks of hair and there's a woman trying to kill me with her car because she's reading a map and driving forward at the same time.
Well, there was somebody looking at your piece in the gallery right as you were about to be hit by a car.
Oh, well, that's interesting. It would have been a fitting way to go.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, locks of hair, wedding presents.
Wedding bands, wedding rings. And I think that's all. I'm obviously not seeing the print in front of me.
Well, it's a distance from me, but it's also feathers, right?
Feathers, yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
feathers are red. Like, to me, they're what I get. It's like what you look at first and what you come back to constantly.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's ironic that I've forgotten it. That was one of the main sort of images, both conceptually and visually, within the work. Because, I mean, I think they're very vibrant and red and beautiful and sort of makes the work visually look kind of very compelling, I hope, and sort of seductive and draws you in. And then conceptually it sort of ties to, it's part of the text where it says the person, you know, thought that he had a cardinal feather stuck in the bottom of his boat, and it turned out to be sort of a red ribbon clinging to the bit of hair of a girl who had that hair ripped out of herself.
Yeah. So this piece, I feel like it's, to me, it feels like a shift. Does it feel like a shift to you from your previous works, or do you feel like it's kind of just part of a wave of?
Well, sort of both. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's a continuation because a lot of my work has been social. Are you still there?
Yes, a lot of your work has been what?
Socially engaged in dealing with a lot of important sort of political and ideological questions confronting people for quite some time, and I had been doing some screen prints for a while, but I work in a variety of ways, and much of the work is, I would say more direct in some senses, and this is perhaps more evocative in some ways.
I would have said seductive, like there's something...
Yeah. And so, in that sense, it is sort of a shift or deepening or sort of engagement with the work and sort of a new way to kind of approach things. And I've always sort of firmly believed that sort of art that talks about the world we live in can be packaged in a lot of different ways. Or not packaged, but it can address these contradictions in a range of ways. And, but a lot of the ways I've found to do it is hitting somebody over the head. And much more direct, but this time it's like I was trying to sort of speak with a different voice. Mm-hmm. And you might lose the signal in a second. I've just walked through the door of the gallery.
Oh, exciting!
My cell phone might cut off. So.
Okay.
If you lose me, I'll be right there. No need to panic. I'm coming up the stairs now.
Congratulations.
Yes, congratulations. What a New York interview. The gallery's been shut. Where do I find you? Oh, there you are.
Hi, Fred.
Hi.
All right.
So I'm going to hang up the cell phone, and hopefully you've got a microphone for me.
I do have a microphone for you. So I've been having microphone problems. We got started a little late today because one of them wasn't working, but they both seem to be working fine now.
Well, do I have the one that's not working fine?
It's the plug-in, and at this point I don't remember which was plugged into which. So.
Yeah, that's a trick. They give the guest the bad microphone so that the host never is cut out, but the guest is butchered.
You keep talking, because
so
I want to check your levels.
I'm trying to extend the cord a little bit. There we are. I'm talking.
Okay, great.
My cell phone's now going off. Somebody wants to reach me. I'm going to turn it off. This is the craziest interview I've ever had. and I just answered and hung up on the person. I hope they don't mind. Maybe they're listening online. They'll figure it out. So.
Oh, Dredd.
Yes.
I don't know why I'm getting such low signals on you.
I don't know either.
Okay, better.
Is that better?
Better.
I guess my shirt had twisted over the microphone. So.
Better. Great.
So, yeah.
So, okay, how do you like this new voice, meaning in your piece that you have here?
Well, I like it a lot, but I guess I don't think there's any one particular way that's necessarily better or worse to sort of make art about the world we live in. I mean, I think there are different ways, and they speak to different people sometimes, but... I do like having sort of more richness and complexity, but it's not to say that I won't go back and do some more, direct or less evocative work. But, I think this is really, in a certain sense, living with the piece, it kind of really grows on you and works on you in a whole different way, and particularly since the text is very... very subtle. I mean, there are times when you can sort of not notice it.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of living with it, it just really works for me on a lot of different
mm-hmm.
levels.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly given that part of the sort of point of the text in a certain sense is that
here's this thing which seems very attractive and seductive, but when you get up close to it and look at it, it turns to one of the most horrible things you've ever seen, kind of, and sort of the imagery is, you know, having, I mean, it, just knowing that there was like a wedding party, which is, you know, ostensibly a very happy day in many people's lives, and then to have it bombed by the U.S. and you just have, you know, chunks of charred meat on, you know, that's really disgusting in a certain sense, but it's also very much, I think, kind of the world we live in, and people, you know, in America have, many people in America, not everybody, but have sort of the privilege of having the illusion that, sort of like living in Tony Soprano's house, you know, it's like everything's all good and you don't necessarily have to look at where all the nice stuff comes from. But when you do look at it, it's like, oh my God, there's blood and bones underneath all this opulence and you know, lifestyle that many people have here. And so it's like, I think that, you know, looking at both the history and the current day America, it's like, what is it built on? I mean, historically, you know, slavery played an integral part to the accumulation of wealth for many people. And you know, the tremendous suffering and brutality described by Toni Morrison in Beloved. And then today, it's like, well, you know, that situation hasn't changed all that much for black people. But internationally also, you've got, you know, just people trying to have a, you know, a party, a wedding party to celebrate. And yet, you know, they're blown to bits for nothing more than living in the wrong place when the U.S. decides to bomb them. And I think that, and so bringing it back to the work is sort of like, I think, you know, having work that is very attractive, and you think, boy, this is really pretty, it's, you know, so nice above my sofa, but then it's like, oh my God, I have to think about all of this. It's kind of an interesting, you know, sort of way for the work to work, and it's different than something
like
in your face.
Well, and it just seems like another tool to have in your toolbox, not that you would give up working one way and decide to work another way, but more like it expands your possibilities.
No, I mean, I definitely, you know, think that, I mean, one of the things that for me is exciting about being an artist is that you can work in so many different ways and do so many different things, and I've never understood sort of the artists who find one particular formal strategy and only do that. I mean, some of the work is like really interesting. People do that, you know, badly, other people do it well, but I've always liked, lots of different ideas. Like, didn't you become an artist because you wanted to sort of think different and be different? And we'll, you know, continue that through your whole life in a certain sense. And so, you know, it's, I think, you know, as I get, you know, long in the tooth or old or mature or whatever they call us artists who are long out of art school, you know, it's kind of interesting and fun and keeps it stimulating to try and find different ways to, different strategies to work.
Geraldine Ehrman just walked into the gallery. I think that's great, and it's great to hear you say those things. She's dancing and distracting me, sorry. So can you talk a little bit about, speaking of like where being long out of art school, can you talk a little bit about like starting, like for people, I mean, I think a lot of people listening, the three people listening.
Well, there's four. There's more. I
think about this. And then tomorrow, people will be listening in the gallery. But can you talk about sort of like how you came to political activism and art making, and sort of the combining of the two? I mean, part of what's so exciting to me to get to talk to all of the artists in the show is kind of learning about everybody's path they've made.
Yeah, how they got to here. Well, no, for me it was kind of, I mean, it's like, you know, I was growing up in like Reagan America, and you know, most people that I knew anyway, I mean, that was just like, wow, there's some fool who had the push of a button because like Messiah told him so he could destroy the world, and so that's kind of messed up. I don't want to live in that world. And it was like, whole sections of people, including a lot of youth, to like, you know, risk everything or try and risk everything to prevent nuclear war, and so that was the time I grew up in, and it was the time when there was, you know, visual art, but more importantly, like, you know, music really sort of challenged all that. You know, I grew up a punk rock kid, and you know, the Clash really, you know, was sort of oxygen in a suffocating environment, and you know, as And so that was one stream, and that was politicizing me, and I was going to demonstrations and stuff. And I also happened to be in art school, and it's kind of funny, you know, it's like in art school, it's not like they teach you how to make art against the status quo, or at least when I was going there. I mean, maybe now they do. Apparently, kids are telling me, you know, oh yeah, I studied you at school. I'm like, what? All right, whatever. But it's like when I was in school, they, you know, it's like they didn't teach that. I mean, or didn't teach it very much. And so I was just making this art, which had, you know, was edgy, but it wasn't really consciously taking on the big questions in the moment. And then I suddenly said, well, why? You know, I'm going to demonstrations, I'm reading revolutionary literature, I'm a communist at a certain point, it's like, you know, a revolutionary, why do I have this, like, sacred sphere of art that the politics never enter into, especially if, like, music is my life, and that's art, and so why not try and bring them together? And as somebody who was, like, in photography mostly, I didn't do that in photography at first, because that's really what I was, like, good at, and was my safe, sacred sphere, and I was like, no, politics shouldn't touch that and degrade it, so I liked doing performance, which was mandatory and required, and it's like, but since I didn't care about it, I could have a lot more freedom in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing these, like, performances and video pieces that really tried to grapple with what I was thinking about at the moment, and then once I did that there, I was like, wait a minute, I can do this with photography, which I happen to be a lot better at, I think. And, you know, and so then at a certain point I made work that sort of, I really wanted to, I mean, I was trying to do a lot of things, but one of them was trying to make work that was accessible to a broad range of people, and both sort of accessible in terms of content, but also in terms of ownership. I mean, it's like I hated that, sort of like basically only rich people could own art, so I started doing these offset prints so that like 1,000 people could own each of my works, and it might not be as good as the fine, you know, photography, but it was like pretty damn close, so it's like I did that. And at the same time I was also concerned about, you know, making socially engaged work, political work, whatever, that wasn't something that was like dismissible. I mean, I hated the fact that sometimes people would go and they'd look at a work and either they'd like it or they wouldn't like it, but they would be able to just not engage with it and walk by. So I wanted to make participatory work where they sort of were involved in the work itself. I started doing these installations for audience participation, which had sort of some sort of photo montage and text and a photograph that was sort of, you know, so, you know, cops beating people up, soldiers marching, stuff like, you know, images drawn from the moment, and you know, things like, you know, people getting arrested at demonstrations, Palestinian youth throwing rocks back at their oppressors and stuff. And so, you know, it had those images, and then they had questions or statements that said, and then it said, like, look, if you agree with this statement or question, you know, feel free to take one of these offset prints, and but you got to write why you took it in the book below, because it was a book that people could write why. And so it involved the audience and expanded it beyond what I, you know, really thought. And it was like, wow, this is really great. I'm kind of onto something. So I did these.
That's some of my favorite work, actually. Yeah. I show that to my students.
Yeah.
Always.
Cool.
Yeah.
I like the work, too. Although it's kind of funny. It's like, on the one hand, I think, in many ways, my art has gotten a lot richer since I've gotten older. But on another hand, at least, I think, in terms of, like, formal strategies, like, it's, some of my best work was done, you know, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. And it's kind of weird. I mean, I think that politically the work has gotten richer and more sophisticated on a mm-hmm. certain level, but you know, it's kind of a weird thing. You when you're in art school or when you're young in general, you question everything and you think about everything, and you, even if what you're inventing has already been invented before by 1,000 people or more, you don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're always inventing mm-hmm. stuff. And it, out of that naivete, it's like you can create some things that as you get older, you might stop yourself from creating because you know that it's been done before. And so it is kind of this funny thing, how to stay new and fresh. And it's a tricky thing for older artists. And I like a lot of my work. I think it's really powerful. But, you know, yeah, looking back, some of that work, you know, on the one hand, some of it had been done before, but on the other hand, I think I got a really interesting new synthesis that it's like, I couldn't have made it if I didn't say no about Hans Hacke. But it wasn't Hans Hacke, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, there's something about the generosity of it. I mean, just the simple, like, that I think is really beautiful. Like, this idea of giving something as well.
Yeah.
Physical, giving something physical.
I mean, you know, it's like, it's kind of weird. I mean, as a visual artist, you know, you're in this weird position where if other artists, if you're a, you know, a novelist that's lucky to be published, or a musician that's lucky to have their stuff recorded and distributed, or a filmmaker who has, you know, has a chunk of, I mean, work is seen by a lot of people.
and usually in its original form, you know, with something close to that. Whereas visual artists, I mean, there's this whole, you know, thing where there's the training and sort of part of objectively is part of the medium, that it really is these rare single objects sometimes. And in a certain sense, I mean, it's, you know, only a few people could enjoy them. It's kind of funny, I was talking to somebody in the gallery after the Scream was stolen, and they, you know, jokingly said, well, wouldn't it be neat if the people stole it just because they wanted to have it in their living room?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that it's like, you know, it is this weird thing that, you know, that some people are making stuff that only a few people will see, and I wanted to try and break that down in a certain sense. And, you know, you can take that to kind of an absurd point where it really becomes just about having multiples regardless of what the content is,
right,
and thinking that people won't see it if there isn't a multiple, because now as an older artist who sometimes shows in these interviews, this is someone who's actually seen by, you know, tens of thousands of people. Like,
mm-hmm.
School kids get taken to see the show, so it's not like I, you know, was reaching as many people even when I had 1,000 copies of an offset, even if,
right,
I gave away all 1,000, which rarely happens. You know, it's like the only way to attack that isn't by just making, you know, sort of inexpensive art that could be distributed in multiples, but that is one way.
Right.
And I do think that, you know, visual artists, we have to, I mean, I think really think about distribution and stuff, because there are whole sections of the people who were locked out of, you know, even if they like live right next door to a museum or gallery, they won't go in it. They won't either make them feel comfortable there, or they're stupid, or they're, you know, look treated like they're going to rip off the place or something. Or, and you know, I don't have to work in.
Or cost $15 to get into it.
$15 to get in. Like, yeah. Seeing a show of Soviet art at the Guggenheim years ago and paying $14 to see it, it's like,
yeah,
it's not right.
Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes left, and I guess I feel like I want to ask you about, like, right now, like, the time right now. Like, what's feeling urgent to you? I mean, there's so much energy in New York right now, and, like, how are you harnessing that in your work or your life, and what do you feel like is important to say right now, or... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think I know what you mean. When I answer the question, maybe you'll say, you didn't know what I mean.
I don't know that I know what I mean.
Well, I mean, I think, first off, it's really good you're asking that question. I mean, and I think it is a question a lot of people are asking, but it's also it's a question that isn't supposed to be asked that much in the art world, kind of, and so it's really good you're asking. I mean, I'll give you a short answer, and I'll give you a long answer. The short answer is, people need to lift their sights to dream the world they want to live in, and in particular, I think it's possible to, you know, fight for a world that has no classes. But in order to do that, you actually have to make revolution. People need to make revolution, and, you know, they need to seize power, and then they need to establish a dictatorship of the proletariat that can lead towards eliminating divisions between mental and manual labor, where you say have a section of society that works with their head and makes art, and the rest of the world feeds us. You know, break down the divisions between rich and poor, between large nations and small nations, between town and country, between men oppressing and dominating women. That's only going to get eliminated if you can get rid of the system of capitalism that perpetuates and feeds upon that. And so that's sort of the big thing that people, I think, need to set their sights on, living in a world we actually want to live in and what it's going to take to get there. And then in particular, there's a huge obstacle to that right now, and that's the whole, you know, agenda of war for empire that Bush and his team kind of concentrate, and they're coming to town. And it was really heartening to open up the New York Times today and see an article that just documented so many different shows, art shows, that are like, you know, all these artists and gallerists and curators, you know, from the Whitney Museum curators to people in small places, you know, that, you know, probably don't even get in the New York Times all that much, are saying, this world is intolerable. We cannot live in this world the way it is. We're disgusted by Bush and everything he represents. And hopefully more of them will also become disgusted by Kerry and fight as determinedly against that too. But, you know, whether you vote or not, the point is, it's like, we have to find a way to resist. And many artists, I think, have stepped to the plate and are hopefully going to acquit ourselves very well in this era. There will hopefully be a million people out in Central Park, you know, not shuttled off to the side, you know, on Sunday in the token demonstration, but actually a powerful, utter rejection that rejects the mandate that Bush and everybody wants to solidify this, you know, war for empire agenda and gutting of civil rights and domestic repression, you know. And so I think that it's like, they're heavy times to live in with kind of sort of a potential for great danger, but also profound opportunities. I mean, some people, I think, are really worried and nervous, and in a certain sense, it's right to be worried and nervous. There's a lot that pivots on this moment, not just the Republican National Convention, but the whole period leading up through the election and, you know, perhaps beyond, that the world could get drastically worse. If they get, like, an utter mandate for this and not a profound agenda, no matter who wins, the world is going to get plunged into darkness, far more darkness. And the people, you know, the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and Colombia and Nicaragua Nepal and Iran, they're counting on people here to really reject that agenda, and they really want to. And so, you know, I think that it's sort of, in that lies a lot of opportunity, because, you know, when people are really questioning, I think that we can look for some real answers and try and, in the midst of that, connect up with revolutionary leadership. And I think people really got to check out Bob Avakian, who's, you know, a great communist leader and has a lot to say about this moment. There's, you know, this beautiful movie, you know, 14 hours of him breaking down revolution, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about. And just find the ways to connect up with the revolutionaries, because the people who are, like, invested in this system are not going to take people where they want to go.
It's great. You're so articulate. I feel like such a geek doing this radio show. Like, all I really want is to hear people like you talk about what moves you, and I feel like I'm learning so much, and I'm supposed to be articulate doing a radio show. Anyhow, it's really, it's great.
Well, it's great that Thanks. You're doing it. I love weird stuff like this. I mean, who else would be Radio Free Erica? And, you know,
well, do you know, like, is there anything you want to announce? You were talking about that a million people in Central Park. So are people talking about actually showing up in Central Park? Are there things that you want to point people that are listening to? You know.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I think people are going to Central Park. I mean, it's going to be, you know, beautiful chaos, I think, because, you know, powers that be are determined not to have any resistance right now, and, you know, they've denied the permit, and so we'll see what happens. I mean, maybe they'll declare, you know, they'll bring out their stormtroopers and not let anybody in. I don't think that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, I don't know.
Right.
People should go there. That's, if people have hope for the future and want to stand with the people of the world, you know, they got to be out on the 29th and be out in Central Park and not just sort of, you know, because otherwise, the alternative is the other side says, hey, we're going to kill all these people and invade all these countries and treat them to war and gut civil liberties and wage domestic repression and disappear people. What are you going to do about it? Oh, you're willing to just ignore it and, like, stand by the river and sing some hippie songs? We'll continue that. But people don't have to go. I mean, they have people have tremendous initiative going into the war, and millions of people, you know, made powerful demonstrations against it and in solidarity with people in Italy and Spain and France and all over, you know, in Nepal, and it was just amazing, and people need to seize that initiative back, because right now we're sort of losing some ground. So be out on Central Park on the 29th, and then also, I mean, as I said, there's this new talk by Bob Avakian on DVD. It's screening around New York City to coincide with the RNC. Their theaters, you know, in Harlem is showing a gigantic art space. You can go to, you know, giganticartspace.com and check their listings. In the Village Voice, there's a listing. It's showing in, like, about five or six different places. Most importantly, it's showing at Revolution Books, which is 9 West 19th Street, and screening regularly and screening tonight at 7 o'clock. And so people should check that, because, you know, I think there's a
all 14 hours of it is screening tonight?
I don't think all 14 hours is screening tonight. I mean, they're probably screening a section of it, and then people could buy the DVD and take it home and study it and read it. And, you know, it's like, but maybe they will be screening 14 hours over the course of a convention. I don't know, you know. But they can, you know, call up Revolution Books to go by and see what they got. But, it, you know, it's like, I mean, it's a heavy, heavy talk, which ain't nobody's talking like this. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, having the opportunity to see Lenin before the revolution. And so, you know, I think many people who might be a little bit, like, cynical about communism now, if they lived in Russia in 1916 or 1917, they would have known what Lenin was saying. They might have still been cynical, but they would have checked it, and they would have gone there. And it's like, and I think in that spirit, it's like, these are desperate, desperate times. And, you know, it's like, it's not going to do to you know, just reformulate sort of anti-Bush slogans. I mean, we need a lot of anti-Bush slogans. Mm-hmm. People got to set their sights on a liberating future. And I think Avakian does that. And I think people should really
check out what he has to say, and some people will be, I think, you know, have their minds blown by it, because it's like really profound and rich and deep, and so that's the advice. And are we treading water until somebody else comes, or is this the somebody else?
No, this is Geraldine Ehrman. She's visiting. Hi, Athene. So I'm going to call Ricardo actually next.
Okay.
But thank you so much.
Well, thank you for doing this.
For the pointers and for the walk and and your wife and kid are going to be here at 2:30.
Well, the other thing I would say, and part of shameless self-promotion, there are all these art shows that are around. People should go see them, and I'm in a couple of them. I'm in the one that's here that's like where Radio Free Eric is happening, but also there's the Freedom Salon, which is a Dykes project.
Which sounds fabulous.
It's a cool show. I've seen some of it. Is that Ricardo calling? We should go. Maybe it's Ricardo.
It's Jenny.
Well, she's early.
How do I do this? I'm going to do that. All right. I'll check the message after. All right, so Deitch Project, and that opens, is that open
Saturday,
today? Saturday
night, okay. I think 6 to 8, and it's actually the Wooster Street Deitch, not the Grand Street Deitch. It's around the corner, but it's...
Yeah, it's such a great space, though, that
one.
It's nice and big, and it'll be perfect.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so next I'm going to call Ricardo, and... Oh, hi, Jenny. Okay, great. Bye-bye. She's just around the corner from the gallery. She'll be here at 2:30. All right. So... Now we're calling Ricardo Dominguez from Electronic Disturbance Theater. Ricardo, it's Erica DeVries, and why don't you give me a call back at 917-414-0276 when you get a chance. Thanks. So Ricardo is, I think, at a sit-in at this right now, so maybe he's engaged. Oh, yeah? That's great. Hello, Jeffrey in San Diego. So I'm going to read to you, Jeffrey, a little bit. I've been reading every day a little bit from an Arundhati Roy essay called Come September. It's a lecture that she actually gave in Santa Fe, New Mexico in 2002. And she's the author of The God of Small Things, which is a beautiful novel, and she's also just a very poignant essayist and citizen of the world / activist. So she was writing about September and their anniversaries and had segued into discussing the Palestinian-Israel situation. This has been my quote-unquote bedtime reading. I usually ended the program with it, but now I'm going to use it to fill a little bit of time in hopes that Ricardo will get back to me.
Young Palestinians who cannot contain their anger turn themselves into human bombs and haunt Israel streets and public places, blowing themselves up, killing ordinary people, interjecting terror into daily life, and eventually hardening both society's suspicion and mutual hatred of each other. Each bombing invites merciless reprisals and even more hardship on Palestinian people. But then suicide bombing is an act of individual despair, not a revolutionary tactic. Although Palestinian attacks strike terror into Israeli civilians, they provide the perfect cover for the Israeli government's daily incursions into Palestinian territory. The perfect excuse for old-fashioned 19th century colonialism, dressed up as a new-fashioned 21st century war. Israel's staunchest political and military ally and is and always has been the U.S. government. The U.S. government has blocked, along with Israel, almost every UN resolution that sought a peaceful, equitable solution to the conflict. It has supported almost every war that Israel has fought. When Israel attacks Palestine, it is American missiles that smash through Palestinian homes, and every year Israel receives several billion dollars from the United States. What lessons should we draw from this tragic conflict? Is it really possible for Jewish people who suffered so cruelly themselves, more cruelly perhaps than any other people in history, to understand the vulnerability and the yearning of those whom they have displaced? Does extreme suffering always kindle cruelty? What hope does this leave the human race with? What will happen to the Palestinian people in the event of a victory? When a nation without a state eventually proclaims a state, what kind of state will it be? What horrors will be perpetrated under its flag? Is it a separate state that we should be fighting for, or the rights to a life of liberty and dignity for everyone regardless of their ethnicity or religion? Palestine was once a secular bulwark in the Middle East, but now the weak, undemocratic, by all accounts corrupt, but avowedly non-sectarian Palestinian Liberation Organization is losing ground to Hamas, which espouses an overtly sectarian ideology and fights in the name of Islam. To quote from its manifesto, "We will be its soldiers and the firewood of its fire, which will burn the enemies." The world is called upon to condemn suicide bombers, but can we ignore the long road they have journeyed on before they arrived at this destination? September 11, 1922 to September 11, 2002, 80 years is a long, long time to have been waging war. Is there some advice the world can give the people of Palestine? Some scrap of hope we can hold out for? Should they just settle for the crumbs that are thrown their way and behave like the grasshoppers or two-legged beasts they've been described as? Should they just take Golda Meir's suggestion and make a real effort to not exist? In another part of the Middle East, September 11th strikes a more recent chord. It was on the 11th of September 1990 that George W. Bush Sr., then President of the United States, made a speech to a joint session of Congress announcing his government's decision to go to war against Iraq. The U.S. government says that Saddam Hussein is a war criminal, a cruel military despot who has committed genocide against his own people. That's a fairly accurate description of the man. In 1988, he razed hundreds of villages in northern Iraq and used chemical weapons and machine guns to kill thousands of Kurdish people. Today we know that that same year the U.S. government provided him with $500 million in subsidies to buy American agricultural products. The next year after he had successfully completed his genocidal campaign, the U.S. government doubled its subsidy to $1 billion. It also provided him with high-quality germ seed for anthrax, as well as helicopters and dual-use material that could be used to manufacture chemical and biological weapons. So it turns out that while Saddam Hussein was carrying out his worst atrocities, the U.S. and the U.K. governments were his close allies. Even today, the government of Turkey, which has one of the most appalling human rights records in the world, is one of the U.S. government's closest allies. The fact that the Turkish government has oppressed and murdered Kurdish people for years has not prevented the U.S. government from plying Turkey with weapons and development aid. Clearly, it was not concern for the Kurdish people that provoked President Bush's speech to Congress. What changed? In August 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. His sin was not so much that he had committed an act of war, but that he had acted independently, without orders from his masters. This display of independence was enough to upset the power equation in the Gulf. So it was decided that Saddam Hussein be exterminated, like a pet that has outlived its owner's affection. The first Allied attack on Iraq took place in January 1991. The world watched the primetime war as it was played out on television. In India those days, you had to go to a five-star hotel lobby to watch CNN. Tens of thousands of people were killed in a month of devastating bombing. What many do not know is that the war did not end then. The initial fury simmered down into the longest sustained air attack on a country since the Vietnam War. Over the last decade, American and British forces have fired thousands of missiles and bombs on Iraq. Iraq's fields and farmlands have been shelled with 300 tons of depleted uranium. In their bombing sorties, the Allies targeted and destroyed water treatment plants, aware of the fact that they could not be repaired without foreign assistance. In southern Iraq, there has been a fourfold increase in cancer among children. In the decade of economic sanctions that followed the war, Iraqi civilians have been denied food, medicine, hospital equipment, ambulances, clean water, the basic essentials. About 500,000 Iraqi children have died as a result of the sanctions. Of them, Madeleine Albright, then U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, famously said, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." Moral equivalence was the term that was used to denounce those who criticized the war on Afghanistan. Madeleine Albright cannot be accused of moral equivalence. What she said was just straightforward algebra. Deanie, can I ask you to talk about what you've been observing around? No?
I haven't actually been.
You haven't been? In New York? Where have you been? Okay, all right, hold on. Talk to me about it. Tell me what's going on in Vermont. And yeah. This is Geraldine Ehrman. She's a Brooklyn-based artist and a member of the Dear Girlfriends group that I was talking about earlier that I'm going to call into. I'm going to call into you guys tomorrow if you're marching with Lori. She's going to give me... So you've been in Vermont?
I've been in Vermont. We decided to leave town before all hell broke out.
Oh, but you're back.
We're back.
Hell, no, this is when hell's breaking out.
I know. Well, I actually didn't want to miss it. It was like going to Switzerland.
That's how
I always figure. My vague recollections of Switzerland are like my vague recollections of Vermont. It's kind of beautiful and quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Neutral.
And where were you?
We were near Montpelier in the Green Mountains.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And see, Paul's got a college friend that lives up there. And his daughter, one of his kids had just graduated high school, and they were joking about, she got a call from Army recruiters.
Oh my goodness.
And her dad's an attorney, and he said, oh, it's part of the No Child Left Behind Act. And I thought it was a joke. And it wasn't.
Oh.
Part of the No Child, I'm not sure I understand how or why this works, but part of the No Child Left Behind Act meant that all this information about contacting all the people who are graduating, like all the contact information is made public, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So I guess all these kids are probably all over the country, but certainly in Vermont.
That's bizarre. I mean, you talk about it being made public, but that's not, that's still like the government, you know? It's bizarre.
It was sort of a bad joke.
And so what are people, I mean, the people that you had contact with in Vermont, are people talking about the RNC? Are they talking about the elections?
Yeah, but I think Vermont has sort of a history of being somewhat liberal, right?
No, absolutely. When you said, like, it's neutral, like Switzerland, like, I guess if you're a liberal person, it feels neutral.
If you're a Deaniac, I come
from here. A Geraldine Yak. So what are people talking about?
Well, the few people that we talk to, we all sort of scowl and fulminate against Bush and, you know, what's it, single wake up and it will be over.
Yeah. And are people talking about, so if Bush actually loses and Kerry wins, then what? Like, then do we just get to not worry about it anymore?
No, of course not, because we have this huge disaster to clean up.
Yeah.
Like we've left Iraq and devastated. Yeah, I know. And then, of course, there's the economy to deal with, too.
Yes.
Which is decimating everything and leaving these huge amounts of debt.
Yeah.
No. But at least we could be more hopeful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know. So you're marching tomorrow? You can't march because you'll be here.
I'm going to be, yeah, I'm actually broadcasting from home tomorrow. I'm just here a few days because I use their dial-up, and it's their phone also, so it's not really so. And anyhow, so I'll be from home tomorrow and then here on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
I went by Dice Project because I had briefly, I sort of scanned the times this morning. I didn't read it really closely. So I thought I was going to go rest and see the show.
Right.
I was really excited, and then I walked in and they were all
installing. Yeah. That's cool. You get to see it in different stages. Cindy's admiring the table.
Velveteen, for those of you that can't see it.
Yeah, green velvet. And actually, it was
Santa Barbara.
Actually, I borrowed this from someone in undergraduate school and then never gave it back. Isn't that terrible? And I think subconsciously it was intentional, but I didn't mean to not give it back.
Hey, you've been in California.
Yeah, we were in California. We were in California for 3 weeks.
Was it nice?
It is very nice. California, you know, it's like an alternate universe.
How's Dove?
Dove is great. He's with Grandma. Actually, now maybe he's changing over shifts from with Grandma to with Dad. But he's great. His Grandma is, like, she's just so generously been caring for him so I can be doing this and Mark can be doing the show. It's been pretty...
And the show's good.
Oh, thanks.
I'm sorry we missed your opening. We were on route.
Oh, from Vermont.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great, though. You get to see it now, and you actually get to see it. Yeah. Although the opening was never totally mobbed. It was very full, consistent, but never totally mobbed.
We were watching her on TV in Vermont.
her being Arundhati Roy.
Yeah, and my husband's a hero. Heroine?
Yeah.
Heroine?
Yeah. Me too.
She adores her. Yeah, she's pretty amazing.
She's, I think, my favorite writer.
She's amazing. And
ever.
She's lovely.
Yeah.
She's kind of amazing. In that book, the novel.
Yeah. No, I feel like her ability to point, like it just clearly put her finger on so many complex issues, like globally, and how they're all intertwined, you know, unfortunately often because the United States is involved in them and their interconnectedness. But I think she's thoughtful, she's human, I mean, she's and beautiful.
Yeah, I know. Speaking of interconnectedness, we saw the corporation, and I don't know if it's still here, but...
Oh, yeah, it was...
Everyone's listening, go, go.
Go see the corporation. Yeah, was at the film
remarkable,
forum.
Remarkable, yeah. It's
and
really
that's
remarkable.
A friend of yours...
He's a writer on it, Harold Crook.
Uh-huh.
He assisted, I guess, there's a book written by a lawyer, Joel, his last name, I can't remember. He's one of the people that initiated the film. He and the director. And so Harold has writing credits, and it was really good. It's really well done. And it's pretty phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole barrage of great documentaries coming out.
Isn't it interesting?
Yeah.
It's the time for documentaries.
Yeah.
How else can you say that?
Yeah. I feel like for me right now, and I don't know if it's just because Mark, I mean, everything in our house is like a buzz, but I feel like for me right now, in terms of historical, like I've never felt anything like this before.
Like the 60s or something?
Yeah, like there's like electricity, I feel like, and I'm sure it's just in New York and because of the convention, but
yeah.
Just in terms of the whole U.S., it feels like it's like a historic period. I mean, of course, all periods are historic, but...
Yeah. But then, you know, when we're driving around New England, you saw all these support our troops ribbons on people's cars, which doesn't mean that you're necessarily pro-Bush.
Right, because...
Which is important, right?
Because Kerry supports our troops.
Well, we support people that are
over
there, naively or otherwise, doing what they're doing, I guess.
Hey, Dred, yes, I'm still on air. Ricardo didn't answer his phone.
Jenny should be here.
He's at a sit-in today, I think. Do you know about that he's involved with, a sit-in? I don't know. And he has some new fancy telephone that perhaps isn't functioning. Yeah, exactly. He was given by some group.
Here in New York?
Yeah. Yeah, he has a site up. He's got the piece up along the wall over there, the website. But then there's an actual sit-in that's happening. Mm-hmm. But I think he said he was going to talk to me from it today. But I was also late calling him, so maybe he's something else.
When do your NYU duties
My NYU duties begin
today.
September 2nd is orientation,
oh,
and September 7th is my first day of classes.
Oh, very good, right?
Yeah.
After Labor Day.
Yeah, the day after Labor Day is the first day of classes. Yeah. Yeah. You're taking this off.
I think I should probably hit the road.
All right.
This is really fun. Thank
you. Okay, thanks, Beanie.
Sure.
Dred, do you have more that you want to say?
Jenny.
Until Jenny arrives?
No.
Dred doesn't have. I find that.
Something I wanted to say to you, which is just like this issue of the RW, which I encouraged you to get a while back, which this article and the one about artists, which is an open letter to artists. I think you'd be interested in it, and I'd be interested in knowing what you think.
Okay. Yeah. I would be interested in talking to you more about this, too. I feel like I haven't been able to because I didn't have enough thought about, do you know what I mean? I wasn't able to discuss it because I hadn't thought about it, but now I feel like I've thought a little bit about it. It'd be a very one-way discussion. You'd be talking to me.
Wouldn't be one way down.
Yeah. Exactly. So we're waiting for Jenny to arrive. I could do some more bedtime reading. I've been reading a little bit from this essay on the air every day. From this Come September essay. All right, unless you have some stuff you want to say, then I'm going to read a little bit. Or we could, okay. So we just read about moral equivalence and Madeleine Albright. A decade of bombing has not managed to dislodge Saddam Hussein, the beast of Baghdad. Now, almost 12 years on, President George Bush Jr. has ratcheted up the rhetoric once again. He's proposing an all-out war whose goal is nothing short of a regime change. The New York Times says that the Bush administration is following a meticulously planned strategy to persuade the public, the Congress, and the allies of the need to confront the threat of Saddam Hussein. Andrew Card, the White House Chief of Staff, described how the administration was stepping up its war plans for the fall. From a marketing point of view, he said, you don't introduce new products in August. This time, the catchphrase for Washington's new product is not the plight of Kuwaiti people, but the assertion that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Forget the feckless moralizing of peace lobbies, wrote Richard Perle, chairman of the Defense Policy Board. The United States will act alone if necessary and use a preemptive strike if it determines it's in U.S. interest. Weapons inspectors have conflicting reports. Jenny, whenever you're ready, catch your breath, have a drink.
I
All right, here, I'll give you...
You're on the air right now.
We're on the air right now. The teeth?
Yeah, I knew it. Clip this on?
Yeah, clip it on as close as you can to... Well, there's water here, too, if you want some water.
Okay.
You can go ahead and drink right out of it.
Well, wherever you see it.
Hi. So, Carla, maybe you'll do some talking to Mo if he's getting tired of... you can wait until he comes over here and talks.
Mo and Tanya.
Okay. Bye, Dini. Thanks for talking on the air. Geraldine Ehrman, have you guys met? Yes, you've met at Passover. Dini, Jenny.
So am I?
You are on the air. We're here with Jenny Polak, and we know that Carla's friend is listening in San Diego. How many other listeners there are, we don't know. But thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. I think that's the standard thing, right?
Right. And I wish that I could pull up your web stuff, but I'm afraid to open up the internet as well as be broadcasting on their dial-up. So I guess I'm just asking people to start with describing the work that's in the show, for because people like in San Diego who are listening haven't seen the show or...
Okay, so...
Jenny, just a second. This is, I think, Ricardo calling, and I'm going to just tell him we should reschedule. Hello. Hi, Ricardo? Hi, that's okay. But you know, I'm here with one of the other artists now, and I was wondering if we can reschedule. Shall I email you? Okay, I appreciate you calling, and I'm sorry, I was a little late, and so I don't know if that threw you off. Okay, are you at the sit-in? You are? Can you give a brief description of it? Yes? Okay, I thought that you were doing an actual real sit-in one of these days here as well. The 30th. Okay. Okay, great. All right, so I'll contact you for a time we can speak more at length. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Okay.
You didn't call in at 2.
I called him, and I was a few minutes after, and maybe that was confusing. But you're going to have to speak up a little bit because these mics are not, they're not best ever.
Okay.
So,
can you see if that's all right, like that, or a bit louder?
A bit louder.
I'll try. I don't normally speak very loud, but
exactly.
So, I have two prints, sea prints in the show, which are actually they're of drawings. They're manipulated drawings. They're layered together. In each of them is a sketch plan of an immigration prison by a former detainee, and then overlaid on that is a rendering that I have built up, a computer rendering which produces a 3D view of this of the prison that the inmates or the former inmates have just outlined. And in this case, the two that I have in here, one is San Pedro prison on Terminal Island in California, which is a federal detention center. This is the women's unit there, and the other one is It's called Port Isabel. It's in Texas. It's a terrible sort of prison camp in Texas for a lot of, for a very large one, for a lot of immigrants. And these drawings were, they're based on drawings that I originally solicited and made for a website for the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. That still exists on the Lower East Side Tenement Museum's website.
And if people want to go to it, they can also access it from the Watch What We Say, from the, your artist page at the Watch What...
Is that right? There's a link.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, there's a link there. So there are 10 different prisons, detention centers, as they are officially called. But they are, in fact, many of them are just prisons where immigrants are being kept, because part of the point of the piece is to show the extent of the imprisonment of immigrants in every nook and cranny of the prison system at the moment, because there are so many of them that they spill over into everything, every possible institution that will have them, kind of thing. And because of that, they become very, very isolated and have a great deal of difficulty ever getting out, because they don't have the same right to counsel and this kind of thing that ordinary prisoners have. They disappear. They really just sort of disappear into the system.
So to talk about the pieces, the drawings that you made, what is the process of, how are you making the drawings? Are you making them from...
I first of all, I solicited from all around the country sketch plans or diagrams, whatever people could produce.
You solicited from who?
From either prisoners or former prisoners.
Right, okay, not the actual organization, organization.
No, well, part of the impetus of this is that it's not, you're not generally allowed to get any images of those places.
Right.
You're not allowed to photograph them unless you're sort of some official person, I guess, and even from the outside. And anyway, I wanted to sort of give the power to the people who had the experience. I was interested in the kind of drawings they would produce from memory if they weren't there, and as well in the kind of partial knowledge that they had of the place, that you have of the place if you're locked up in one part of it and taken from maybe A to B, but you don't get to see the whole building. The kind of architectural experience that is interesting to me, and how people represent that is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, I like the kind of transgressive aspect of having people draw these things anonymously, in safety, I think. Which are like escape plans, really, or mm-hmm. they have that feel to them, they're diagrams of these spaces, and in some cases how people are moved around them, shown. And anyway, so what I did when I got these was I got a certain number. It's very difficult for people to do that.
Oh, I'm sure. But difficult for you to get access to people to do that too, I would imagine.
I worked it for about a year, getting access,
yeah.
gradually accumulating contact and accumulating drawings. And but then I scan them all into the computer, and then I trace them. I import them into a MiniCAD program, which allows me to trace the drawings. And there is a kind of thing that interests me, where that's not the way you normally use those programs at all. You normally start from scratch and idealize, project an ideal space. Really.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they're intended to be used. And but this process is a kind of reverse opposite of that in a way, because you start with a very partial higgledy-piggledy drawing in many cases. Well, it depends. So they vary a lot, but once you have that information, it's often non-orthogonal, it's often very, counter to the way the programs were designed to work. And then, so I was kind of making the CAD program obey the memories or follow the memories of the detainees. And what comes out is a very strange kind of hybrid rendering, because then I would project the plans and produce renderings. And in some cases, the detainees will actually have sent more than just the plan. Sometimes they sent a couple of different views, or it just depends. And so that the images that come out vary accordingly.
Right next to you there.
I'm here with my son, who's demanding his refreshment.
His lunch.
The rest of your bagels in the bag as well. You just have to figure out which it is, okay?
I've got my bagel sandwich over here, too.
Okay, oh, thank you. Okay. So, the drawing, but these drawings, the great thing about what you can do on the computer with those, what I love about that is that you basically are creating a model, which you can then you have a sort of freedom to turn it around. Mm. You have a kind of whole freedom of movement that is denied to the detainees, to the prisoners at the time of their detention. So you can sort of give them a sense of control over the, and then by extension the visitors to the website can sort of look at the building from a couple of different angles. It isn't in fact interactive, which would have been my ideal, but we didn't have the technology at the time.
So how would you have people interact with it?
Well, you just all you get is you get a view, and then there's one animation which just goes through. It either gives you a fly through.
But how would you, if you could have people interact with it, like how would you?
I would like to set it up, and in the future when I have more skills, I think I will do it like this, or do another thing like this, which will allow people to move through their, use their controls to explore the building, the guide to structure there.
She didn't mention, but you could probably take them. And she'll put some more out.
All right, you have to sit on this one.
Yeah. I think she's in the back, if you want to ask.
Okay. On a chair.
Oh.
And I'll stand there. It's okay. I'm happy.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah, of course. It's all right.
The right place.
Yes.
If my mic comes with me, I have a step.
So that was something else I wanted to ask you, like in terms of the technology. Like you say, if you have more skills, like did you teach yourself this technology, or did you work? I'm curious because you work in different media, so I'm curious about like your process in choosing media. Like, did you learn that to the CAD program, or had you? How did you come to working with that program?
I have worked for years for architecture. My background is in architecture, and I picked it up. When I trained as an architect, that it was not on computers at all. We drew these things by hand. But my age, I suppose. But very soon after that, it all became computerized. And so I taught myself the basics of like the most simple CAD program to do this. But I collaborated with a web designer to put it up, because that's something I don't yet know really how to do. Although I learned quite a lot in the process about how to transfer the kind of animation that you make for an architectural presentation, for example, onto the web and onto the internet. So, yeah, we worked at that quite a bit to get a particular kind of animation up. But I did learn, I had sort of been learning sort of on the side of my job. I learned the CAD program a little bit. I tend to use whatever bits of skills I can pick up along the way. I always feel that I'm
I'm doing my work in a kind of underskilled way. Mm-hmm. I tend to feel like, but that becomes part of the work in a way. Mm-hmm. I sort of feel like position of not being an expert,
right,
is kind of the position I work from, not fully knowing anything that I'm trying to say, or not fully knowing the tools I'm trying to use, or the content I'm trying to convey.
Uh-huh.
I guess, but it's that's part of what I do.
Yeah.
To say, well, you have to work, you have to go with what you've got,
right,
you'd never do anything.
Right.
In my situation.
Well, and part of maybe the motivation is to learn things in the process, too.
Yeah.
Like, to become more of an expert, or more of less of an expert.
Right. yeah, you pick up a little bit. I always feel I'm doing things rather partially because I have to divide my time in so many ways, but I, whenever possible, I pick up a little more.
Meaning the CAD program, or the direction of picking up more skills?
Oh, in the CAD, both in the CAD program and on the internet.
Right.
I'm about to do another 2 years on now. No, three. Well, actually, nearly 4 years on. I've only done this one web project. I'm going to do another one coming year. But, again, it took a while to put it together.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. Can you talk a little bit about that project that you're working on?
Yes. It's a bit up in the air, though, but it's going to...
I'm just going to... Just a second. Hey, Mo? Mojik? Could you hand your mom your chair and take that chair that's over there? Can you do that, please? Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, that's where Carla was sitting, and she's standing up right now watching the video. Oh, it's great. It's part of the tapestry.
I should explain. Well, my son and his school friend Anya are here with me today.
It is great.
You can go by the window.
Yeah. I wouldn't lean on. Well, there's bars there too. It's fine. I think it's totally fine.
It's airy there.
And it's great to have you guys here. I'm going to ask you some questions if you want to answer them on the radio too afterwards.
This morning, Anya and her mother and I went on the Mother's March across the
country. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So what's the group again? Mob?
Mob. It's Mothers Opposing Bush, I think is what it's called.
Uh-huh.
I don't know much about it. Somebody just let me know this is happening. And it was really the stroller brigade.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like a massive ad for McLaren.
Did you go from Manhattan to Brooklyn?
No.
From Brooklyn to Manhattan. I saw driving in, I saw a bunch of women with strollers. I mean, not like a pack, but
it was small.
Yeah.
It was only on the walkway, but there was no stopping traffic or anything. But, it was friendly, and it
was
a nice way to kick off the weekend.
Absolutely. No, absolutely.
And
I think it's really important to organize as mothers, too, you know?
And to feel powerful as well.
Yeah. I mean, because I think it is really powerful to be organized. I mean, that's...
Right. We have... I think we have some particular things to convey to people.
Absolutely.
Bigger positions and so on. And it affects... It also, of course, affects everything we do.
Yeah, absolutely. So, will you tell me...
We were talking about...
Your new web project.
Yes. After I had been working on detention centers a lot, I wanted to shift slightly into the question of what you would do to stay out of detention if you were threatened with it, and I came up with the idea of working on hiding safely.
And Daddy, down in the jungle?
on the architecture of hiding places. And I've been designing and building hiding places in a couple of different settings over the past year, I guess. And so this new project, which is going to be supported by Franklin Furnace, is an extension of that, where there's going to be a choice of types of just domestic set, so there'll be domestic hiding places where you might perhaps hide in your pattern or kitchen or your bathroom or something like that, or you construct a hiding place. And I'm going to construct some prototypes and also draw them up as sort of how-to manuals. And the website will be a kind of a, like a catalogue, or not exactly that you can order one, but that you can view the installation and use them different types of ways to hide people. And so there will be little short, I don't know if it will be stills or short mini movies showing people disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's partly the sense that I have of the complete kind of naturalization of the computer in the home these days. So I like the idea of people seeing on their screens.
Sort of like a airplane, like evacuation video kind of thing, like that.
Something like that, yeah, where you will have on your screen a view of somebody else's home, I guess, but you'll see me, probably some kids, demonstrating what you do if you need to get into one of these places.
Uh-huh.
And disappear, and then you'll go back to the ordinary domestic being kind of thing.
That sounds great.
And each one will then have a kind of downloadable manual with the drawings. I guess I want very much to relate to the drawn...
Well, again, like the airplane metaphor, it's like the thing in your seat pocket that illustrates what the pretty air hostess was just doing.
Right, right. We'll be doing both of those sides of it, I suppose, and then so I just have to figure out how to do that, but they're going to help me.
That's
the great thing about this grant. So.
Yeah, great. Did you say which grant you got?
I guess it's called The Future of the Present.
Oh, interesting.
It seems very fitting for this.
Yeah, absolutely. Congratulations.
The idea is to, in my mind, is to sort of instigate a new underground railroad type thing for people who need to disappear, and in some cases who need to actually leave the country. That's partly what started me thinking about it when the special legislation was brought in after September the 11th. In which thousands and thousands of people were expected to come and give themselves up, really, to the what was then the IMF, and it caused a huge exodus. People, mainly people of Asian, you know, Pakistani, or what you call here South Asian origin, I guess, were particularly vulnerable to it for various historical reasons, as they didn't have exactly the documents they should have had, and lots of people, so many people fled to the Canada that their whole the borders were choked with people, and some of the borders, crossings were closed down, and whole communities here were emptied out.
Right. I didn't know that about the border crossing. I didn't know that about the Canadian border crossing. I mean,
there was a lot of people trying to help them.
Right.
It was winter time, and people were beginning to kind of stop overnight.
Well, sorry. My monitor.
Mm-hmm.
you might be asked some questions in a few minutes.
Yeah.
If you want, you can talk too.
Great.
Erica's broadcasting to...
On the internet.
On the internet, yeah.
Carly's friend in San Diego is listening.
You remember where it is, huh? Yes. Go on then.
I don't know.
Can you show Anya where the bathroom is?
Yeah, it's fine. So, I guess I'm losing my not so clear thinking further and clear. But I guess I've been wanting to ask all the artists that I've been talking to and just the people I've been talking to in general, like what, like right now, to me, I've never experienced anything like what I'm experiencing right now in terms of electricity within the city. I mean, I guess September 11th, there was like a lot of electricity, but it seems like right now people are really mobilized and pissed off and motivated, and there's a lot happening, and I don't know how, what feels important to you right now, and then what, and then the other thing that I keep coming up against is like, so if Bush loses, then what? Like, do we lose this momentum? Do, you know, I mean, on the individual level and on the, like, does it seem, that wasn't really a question, but.
No, I know what you mean. I think it's very difficult to figure it all out at the moment. I'm actually fairly pessimistic myself. I'm always very pessimistic.
Are you really?
In terms of political reality, yes. Mm-hmm. Not in terms necessarily of... Oh, I just sort of think I feel I have to operate from in a kind of positive way from a position of complete negativity a little bit. I don't have very great expectations. I don't have any expectations of the electoral process here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was shown in the last election anyway. This kind of democracy, it's much the same. I come from England, by the way. It's not the same, but there are, that kind of democracy has its problems too. This kind just seems completely bankrupt as far as I can, you know, or paradoxically, politically, philosophically bankrupt anyway. It can't, everything has to tend towards, really towards a kind of one party, a single ideology, the process makes the parties that have to kind of shadow each other all the time, to try and approximate to each other's positions more and more. Well, that's how it seems to work. I suppose there's just a bigger fear. There's just as big a fear of what would happen if, of a different kind of fear of what would happen if Kerry did get in.
Yes.
Because look what happened when Clinton got in.
Right.
You know, I mean, a lot of the work that I've been doing with around immigration issues for several years really was pushed to a head by legislation that came in under Clinton. Very anti-immigrant legislation, amongst other things, was brought in by his regime. So it's not like I have many illusions that a Democrat solve things. But of course, what happens is people, as you say, we're all pissed off now, relax back and think, phew, you know, at least, as everyone keeps saying, at least the Supreme Court judge appointments will be more moderate, at least, you know,
right,
a couple of things will perhaps be less harsh, so far from, you know, it's so far from
any great ideals that any of us have, I think.
Well, the thing that seems, I mean, I feel really naive saying it, but the thing that's surprising to me is like this idea of like, oh, and then we don't have to worry anymore. And the thing I feel like I've learned and should have always just grown up with, I suppose, but is that we are responsible. We need to be responsible in our, in a larger way, like not just within our homes kind of way, and within, we need to be culturally, socially responsible and active. And I feel ridiculous for like just all of a sudden kind of understanding, because I think in the U.S. we've grown up thinking that it's somebody else's concern, like it's great, we get to go water skiing and not worry about it, you know.
Well, it's because of this damn voting system, right? Being great. Well, it's not so much that you get to go water skiing; you get to go and vote.
Right.
Right.
Right. We get to vote so that we can go water skiing.
That's what I had to do. That's what I do. That's what I can do, and that's it.
And
know?
Then to the mall.
Yes. and that's a very dangerous thing. I think it's calculatedly so.
Yeah.
That's why I say I feel.
Do you think it is? It was always calculatedly so, or do you think that it's transformed itself into be calculatingly so?
I'm not at all a great expert on the history
right.
of stuff. I did once hear Angela Davis actually talking about the history of the democratic process here in England,
mm-hmm.
and how it was constructed around a kind of collective need to set up a prison system.
Mm-hmm.
That was rather an eye-opener for me.
Yeah.
I think there is some kind of historical validity to that. I don't know much about it, so I won't go into it, but the need to kind of regulate your society is very intimately bound up with
right.
the one man, one vote kind of
right.
invention. I don't have answers. People also say, well, what then? In that case,
right.
what?
right.
That's why I say I feel like the only way I seem to be able to go forward is just sort of saying, there's some things that I can represent that I feel are not represented, that are injustices that go on, I just feel like regardless of what vision you might have for the future, if you can just show a lot of people the present, then people are a little more empowered to, you know, to make informed decisions about what they might or might not do. And I have a lot of faith in people's sort of I guess in the end, of people's ability to decide to do the right thing, I think, in the end, but against great odds, I suppose. So I justify my not having, not knowing which political system to
right.
say I would say. I
but to me, I mean, it feels like it's. Yeah, no, I feel like. It's got to, I don't know what I'm, like to say that there's an answer in a specific political system, like, it seems like it's so much more complicated, and and that's, like, kind of, part of it is acknowledging that, and that there isn't an answer, necessarily, but it's like, I feel like there's change is necessary, but there has to be, like, huge dialogue.
Yeah, there has to be some huge I do feel very, part of me does feel very reckless,
mm-hmm.
that I would like to see a huge change.
Oh, absolutely.
And not just a little local change. You know,
absolutely.
Partly because I think what people are beginning to feel is, you know, the incredible sort of danger of this country to the whole world. And I feel like it's taking a long time. You were talking about how there is this kind of excitement right now,
mm-hmm.
say like anger or something,
mm-hmm.
that people are a bit more switched on than they used to be.
Oh, absolutely.
And
way more switched on.
Yet people, I guess, and once they I suppose across the country, they say people are very stuck in their way,
right.
in their views. But I can't believe that some of the revelations about the real, about the various aspects of the current everyday reality for people around the world don't reach. You know, they must be reaching more people than they used to, I think. And I suppose I do think that arrogantly maybe that some of us can sort of connect people with some kind of reality that they've been cut off from, and that's an incredibly important thing to try and do at the moment, to sort of connect people up with what's going on, what's actually happening in the world, and so on, so that America and Americans, you know, they sort of need to get over this whole kind of pride in the country kind of thing, and try and see themselves and the whole institution they're part of as the danger that it is. And
right. It just seems so much more apparent that it's not the country anymore, it's the world, you know, like we are just, it seems like that, the internet, I mean, it just seems like, to me, that's the thing that seems so much more apparent. I mean, the country, like, everything is manufactured, things go up, you know, everything is going out and coming in and going out, and like it just seems like some sort of larger responsibility
mm-mm.
is imminent, you know, like, not that we're in charge of the globe.
We're not going to be in charge of it, but on the other hand, what? Knowledge is very powerful, and well, I'm curious to see what will happen this weekend, and
absolutely, yeah.
And see whether people will be too frightened to do anything. Or
right. Are you going with your kid to Central Park?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start off. Because of having a kid with me, I'm always very. I take stock as I go along, and so we'll start off in Union Square,
right,
at the rally at Union Square,
right,
and see, and then kind of get the latest on how free from conflict Central Park,
right,
is. But the overall idea. Actually, in the end, I kind of feel like apart from the kind of joke really of the denial of the permit, which is a denial of a sound system permit essentially. It's kind of hilarious to me that the grounds for denial are the grass, I think still. But the what's actually being denied is not permission to go and walk on the grass, because apparently they can't really stop people from going into a mm-hmm. public park. Apparently they're not going to be able to just completely barricade the park. But there won't be a centralized sound system, so
I kind of like that idea. Right. Speeches are usually so boring and annoying. All the people are, you know, Dre and I were talking earlier about what people must have used to have done before there was electricity.
Right.
And their music. Right. They all talk to each other right. A bit more. And they maybe, you
some
know,
sort of horn deal.
Various, yeah. Horn or smaller groups would speak to each other and
right.
Take turns to speak out of pocket. Right. I think that's. I think that's rather has a lot of potential, let's put it that way, that for people to free associate in a good way.
I did read an interview with Mayor Bloomberg yesterday in Time Out magazine, and he said it's not because of the grass, it's a safety concern because they can't get proper police representation in there, and that, you know, of course, for people's safety, not in relation to, managing, controlling, exactly, was what he was saying. And then also, what ambulance can't get in there, you know, if there are that many people in there.
Right. Can they really get to a demonstration that's being kind of cordoned off by?
Right.
I mean,
I'm not trying to... I'm just surprised because I kept hearing this thing about the grass, and he said it's not about the grass, it's about this. And I was like, oh, well, okay, that's interesting that he's commenting back, at least.
Well, he's a great one for, he doesn't, I don't think he cared to, he's sort of cleverly unprincipled, you know, opportunistic about what he'll say, like when he sort of debunks the whole idea about people buying duct tape and plastic, you know, after people have been ordered to do that by government, and he just kind of told people not to, and as if, you know, what a silly idea. Sort of like, well, somebody originally said
right.
It's a good idea.
Right.
And in this case, it wasn't. You know, somebody said that nobody could go on. To demonstrate on that lawn across the grass, which is squash.
Right.
But anyway, I don't know. On the subway last night, we in a crowded, kind of late night subway car, there were people were there from Billionaires of Bush.
Oh yeah,
were
great.
Inviting everybody to a croquet game on the lawn.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's so great.
Bring their champagne and celebrate all the good that Bush is doing for them. And the whole subway car was pretty interested.
That's fantastic.
And called upon to say, "Fuck Bush," and there was quite a lot of people that mine. But
that was really fun. Which train?
Which train was it? It was the F train.
Mm-hmm. In Manhattan, or
I was going to Brooklyn.
Coming out of Manhattan.
Home,
uh-huh.
Yeah, coming home train.
Oh, that's really great.
And the other thing that I've noticed recently on the train, though, you know, they've banned photographing on the train.
Well, technically, it's always illegal. Every semester, I have students, photo students, who get.
Oh, it's always illegal.
It's always illegal.
Oh well, they've recently made a fuss about it.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that was any new legislation that they added to it or something, but I actually saw somebody, a citizen, although it might have been a plainclothes cop, I think, stop a tourist from videotaping something very abstract that he was videotaping out of a moving train. And that gave me sort of alarming feeling about how some people are a huge buy into the kind of fear smear kind of
I think
way.
So many people do. I think the majority of people do. I find myself buying into it if I'm not checking myself.
Yeah. When people talk about their own demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, maybe Mo will call in because I'm going to be broadcasting here again on Sunday unless I decide that I just absolutely have to be out also. But I wanted to broadcast and just talk to people on the telephone all day about what they're seeing and their experiences. So maybe Mo would...
They go.
I don't know. It got very quiet. They're probably back there playing with the cats.
Oh, that's is
my
house,
guess.
Is it? There's an apartment with cats back there?
There's
an
apartment.
With the toilet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's separate from the apartment. My guess is that...
Oh,
the, and then there's cats. There's the kitchen and then the restroom area that's... Yeah.
So they probably won't do anything.
I'm sure they won't. And Lisa's back there, the woman who lives there, I'm sure. She's maybe showing them around or something. Well,
I promised them a ride on the paddle boats if they behave themselves.
Oh, excellent. Which paddle boats?
Oh, in Prospect
Park. Oh, that's really fun. Oh, nice.
Next stop.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, that's really nice. What a nice day. Marching. Chatting,
picking up
paddle boating.
Paddle boating, yes, and ice creams after paddle boating if they can agree and don't argue too much about who is paddling and who is steering and which way we're going.
I see you're an experienced paddle boater.
Well, these two are not always very harmonious. but
they seem harmonious in the moments out here.
They will, yeah, they can be.
Well, I think maybe I'll stop the broadcast, even though they're not back yet. I wanted to ask Mo some questions, but...
Do you want to?
Both. Both. Well, I'll talk to him. We'll get him
on
during the march. So thanks so much, Jenny. It's really nice to talk with you about your work and... about what you're thinking about in general.
I guess I have to think some more. I'm not very good at thinking very much. No time to read, that's the problem.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Things just happen and you deal with them.
No, exactly. And so much I feel like just comes from your gut and your instinct.
Yeah.
Like what's okay, what's not okay,
yeah.
And what's, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to manage with the family and everything,
yeah.
And as well as the world,
yeah.
But anything you want to announce that's happening or that you can think of? People are meeting at Union Square on Sunday, do you know what time, 11?
10, I think.
Uh-huh.
There is also, I imagine people know about this already, but tomorrow, which is Saturday, there is a pro-choice march across the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yes, yes.
Maybe people already announced that, which I only recently found out about.
Well, Lori's going to call from that, so you can maybe hook up with her and go.
I might go, I might be going. I'll have to see what I was going to do. But I'm glad that's on as well. I didn't manage to get to the one in Washington recently, which I'm sorry about, so nice to have a local one.
Yeah, yeah.
Always easier to manage, of course. That's right, I think maybe I heard back from Laurie. I was surprised I hadn't heard about it before.
Yeah.
It was a little worrying.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be neat to first one day go on a mother's march and the next day go on a pro-choice march.
Absolutely.
Affirm the connection between the two things.
Yeah, we took the baby with us to D.C. for that march, and that was really, like, it was pretty emotional and kind of wonderful, you know, just having the baby there and just being like, yeah.
I was quite inspired, I know you won't stop, but last night I was at the Unconventional Heroes Award.
Oh, yes.
And I didn't know, but Dr. Pendergrass was there. I don't know if you know who
he is. No, I don't.
I knew about him, but I didn't even know he was free. He's been in prison in Florida. He's a doctor, an abortion provider, who courageously has for years been providing abortions to people in Florida. And the FBI, the federal government, I guess, went after him on a trumped-up charge of some sort and succeeded in... apart from all sorts of other harassment, of course,
but he actually got thrown in jail for, I think it ended up being half a year or something in the end, and then he was thrown out. Then, you know, it was overturned on appeal.
Right.
He's just an incredibly brave person. And there he was. He had been given an award in the past, I think, by Ricky Moses' Reproductive Freedom Task Force, as it's called. I've been in touch with them for a long time because I make posters for them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
In the poster. That most recently, in memory, they did the most recent one last March in a commemoration of Dr. Gunn, who was the first abortion provider to be killed and shot in Alabama. I think he was operating on him. He was killed by a Christian fascist, you know, by a far right Christian person.
I remember.
So, but it was very cool to see him out. I wasn't even sure he was free.
Right.
And have him come up on stage.
That must have been such an emotional event, the whole thing.
The whole thing was. It was really sort of like cheery event.
No, I know.
It was good. I mean, it was actually great artistically as well, because they had some very good performers. Musicians, and the whole thing flowed rather. It did it well, you know, it was long, but it didn't feel long like those things often do.
Right. Carol, has been doing overtime so I can do this program, and Mark can work on the show, and just felt like I couldn't go, but really wanted to. Yeah.
Babysitting.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
that's it.
We're gonna say goodbye and thanks for joining us today, and join us again tomorrow. I'll be broadcasting from home. You can call in there at 718-692-4571 if you want to talk on the air. You can send an email with comments or things you would like to discuss. You could even ask. I could call you in some situations if you want to talk. Tomorrow we'll be talking to the artists Ann Messner and Joy Garnett from the exhibition. We'll also be talking to some women at the Pro-Choice March. We'll be checking in with Wade Nasanovich about his commute and what he sees going on in the city, and we'll be talking to Esther Barlev from Kibbutz Be'eri in the Negev Desert in Israel. So thanks so much, and bye-bye. I'm going to completely cut broadcast now because I have to transport my laptop back home. So we'll be back on, probably rebroadcasting today's show sometime around 8 tonight. Okay, bye-bye.
Erica, you're a champ. You just learned this all on the fly kind of thing.
Well, I mean, yeah, like you said, I was like feeling such connection to what you were saying about.
Yeah, but look what you think you've done.